Tell us a bit more about Fisher's reforms at the Admiralty.
On the 20th of October 1904, Admiral Sir John Fisher, often known as Jacky Fisher, became First Sea Lord. His task at the Admiralty was to find savings. The Navy from the 1890s through to 1904 had been on a steady upward curve of expenditure as the threat from France and Russia and latterly Germany became increasingly powerful. The Royal Navy found itself outnumbered by the three nearest rival powers. And this rising tide of expenditure and the costs of the Second Boer War meant that the British government was desperate to find savings. Fisher got the job by essentially promising that he would find ways of improving efficiency, reducing waste, and saving money. Cut the budget, but retain the Navy at the right level. Fisher is an important figure because, unlike almost all other senior naval officers of the period, he wasn't a conservative. And he wasn't connected with the political or social elite. He was a man who'd risen largely on his own merits to a position of great influence. His political hero was John Bright. His naval hero was Nelson, and his favourite reading was either Nelson or the Bible. To save money, Fisher streamlines a number of processes. But at the same time, he undertakes something absolutely controversial. 2 years earlier, he'd introduced a series of educational reforms aimed particularly at the recruitment of junior officers for the Royal Navy, the Royal Marines, naval engineers. And the clear objective of these reforms was to remove privilege and influence from the selection, promotion, and training of naval officers. And this struck at the heart of what had become a somewhat aristocratic naval leadership. And there were howls of protest that young officers of gentlemanly origin would be forced to study engineering, which was a very dirty and rather greasy process, and thought to be suitable only for people of the middling sort and even the lower orders. And that the Royal Marines, who were by no means as prestigious as they are today, would also be mixed in with this. But Fisher knew exactly what he was doing. The Navy needed to recruit a lot of good people, and recruiting people on the basis of privilege and influence was not going to create a first-class 20th century Navy. He'd seen how the United States Navy had changed its curriculum in a very similar way in order to improve the engineering knowledge of its officers, and this was pushed through by him. He made a lot of enemies, but he didn't mind this. He was a man who liked to fight, if not only a literary one rather than a physical one. His landmark reform was the transformation of capital ship design. And he's famously associated with the battleship HMS Dreadnought, which he had designed and then built very quickly after coming into office. Dreadnought changed the rules of war at sea. Before Dreadnought, battleships had four 12-inch guns, 12 or 14 6-inch guns, and old-fashioned steam engines that might get up to about 18 knots, but not very often. Fisher's Dreadnought had 12 12-inch guns, it had brand new turbine engines, it could make at least 21 knots and could hold that speed for very long periods of time, and it allowed battles to be fought at much longer ranges. It rendered all previous battleships obsolete. This meant the British battle fleet, which was the largest, had the most obsolete ships in it. But it was so transformational that everybody else stopped building battleships for 9 months to 18 months, and some of the naval powers of the world never really recovered from this. Only two other navies built Dreadnought-style battle fleets before 1914, the Germans and the Americans. Nobody else built more than half a dozen of these ships. They simply couldn't afford them, and they couldn't build them. Britain, with the most dynamic shipbuilding sector in the world, built them quickly and economically. And Fisher used this as the basis of an arms race. He'd recognised that Germany was the main threat to British interests and that the Germans were building a navy to challenge the British. He obliged them to build bigger ships, more expensive ships, ships that were not suitable for Germany's relatively shallow coastal waters, and the newly completed Kiel Canal that linked the Baltic and the North Sea through northern Germany. The Dreadnought forced the Germans to rebuild this canal at enormous expense. It forced them to build ships that they hadn't planned to build on a scale they hadn't intended, and it forced them to grapple with new technologies they hadn't yet dealt with. The naval arms race lasted 3 years. The Dreadnought was launched in 1906, and in 1909, Fisher launched a program in which Britain essentially built 9 Dreadnought capital ships in a single year. He set up a little bit of a public scare that the Germans were catching up. They weren't really. He got people in the press to promote that campaign, the We Want Eight and We Won't Wait campaign. Can you imagine today people campaigning in Westminster for more battleships? But such were the times. By the time these ships were finished in 1911-12, the Royal Navy had nearly double the fighting strength of the German fleet, and the Germans abandoned the naval arms race and switched their efforts to rebuilding their army in time to launch the First World War in August 1914. They did it in August 1914 because that's precisely when the Kiel Canal was reopened and allowed Dreadnought battleships to go through it, and Fisher knew this. Fisher had spotted this 6 or 7 years before the outbreak of the First World War. He predicted it very accurately. So what Fisher's job is, essentially, is to continue Britain's position as the leading global power, to protect Britain's interests in global trade, which are expanding, to protect Britain's global investments, which are expanding, to avoid a major war in Europe, which would not be good for business, by deterring German aggression. In the spring of 1906, and during that year, the first Moroccan crisis breaks, and the crisis is solved by Fisher and his friend the King, Edward VII. They send the main English fleet into the Baltic without telling the Germans, and it turns up in a German harbour without being announced, and the Germans immediately decide they won't attack the French. Naval deterrence, naval diplomacy, is Fisher's main weapon. Being able to threaten the Germans with a blockade and attacks on their coast draws them back from launching a war in 1905-6 and again in 1911. And unfortunately, in the July crisis of 1914, Fisher was not in office and was not in a position to put that pressure on the Germans again. The Germans fully expected the British would do this and were somewhat surprised that the British didn't apply pressure. Whether it would have averted the First World War or not really isn't the question. The question is, should it have been attempted? And the answer has to be yes. It was not in Britain's interests for the First World War to break out, and it would have been better all round if perhaps the war had been avoided by a more straightforward piece of diplomacy. Fisher's diplomacy is rather like Lord Palmerston's. He's very keen on making people understand that the consequence of their actions may be negative, unlike the Ministry of July 1914, who were more concerned about the Irish Home Rule Bill and the coherence of the cabinet. What does Fisher do? He modernises the Navy, he transforms its equipment, he introduces new weapons, submarines, he introduces new fueling systems, the switch to oil fuel, which is vital for high-speed endurance. He builds bigger and bigger ships, and he uses them as the basis of a deterrent position in which the British say, we are simply too strong for you to take us on. So why don't you do as we say? He's not in favour of war. In fact, Fisher loathes war and is very much opposed to the use of force, if it can be avoided. His first battle was the Royal Navy's most important defeat of the 19th century, an attack on forts at the entrance to the Taku River, in which he saw many of his friends killed and ships sunk. He saw no reason to go to war. He thought it was much better to be overwhelmingly powerful and to be able to avoid war from a position of strength. His effect on the Navy was, it might be said, controversial. Those who opposed him did so largely on social and political grounds, and over time their opposition became increasingly ridiculous. And by the outbreak of the First World War, it was very much Fisher's Navy, and the men who commanded it were the men that he had raised and trained, and key people that he had run through his system would direct the war at sea. And his legacy was the Royal Navy of the 20th century, a dynamic, aggressive, positive force that was able to achieve outstanding results to an extent in the First World War, but more particularly in the Second.